She had listened, hearing through his words the sound of Reardon's voice, saying to her on a spring evening over a year ago, "They need some sort of sanction from us. I don't know the nature of that sanction, but, Dagny, I know that if we value our lives, we must not give it to them. If they put you on a torture rack, don't give it to them. Let them destroy your railroad and my mills, but don't give it to them."
"Now do you see?"
"Oh, yes, Jim. I see." He could not interpret the sound of her voice. It was low. It was part moan, part chuckle, part triumph. But it was the first sound of emotion to come from her, and he plunged on with no choice but to hope.
"I promised them in Washington that you'd speak. We can't fail them. Not in an issue of this kind. We can't afford to be suspected of disloyalty. It's all arranged. You'll be the guest speaker on Bertram Scudder's program tonight at 10:30. He's got a radio program where he interviews prominent public figures. It's a national hookup. He has a large following. He reaches over 20 million people. The office of the morale conditioner is..."
"The what?"
"The morale conditioner. That's Chick Morrison. Has called me 3 times to make sure that nothing would go wrong. They've issued orders to all the news broadcasters who've been announcing it all day, all over the country, telling people to listen to you tonight on Bertram Scudder's Hour."
He looked at her as if he were demanding both an answer and the recognition that her answer was the element of least importance in these circumstances. She said, "You know what I think of the Washington policies and of Directive 10-289?
At a time like this, we can't afford the luxury of thinking."
She laughed aloud.
"But don't you see that you can't refuse them now?"
he yelled. "If you don't appear after all those announcements, it will support the rumors. It will amount to an open declaration of disloyalty." "The trap won't work, Jim."
"What trap?"
"The one you're always setting up."
"I don't know what you mean."
"Yes, you do. You knew, all of you knew it, that I would refuse. So you push me into a public trap, where my refusal would become an embarrassing scandal for you. More embarrassing than you thought I'd dare to cause. You were counting on me to save your faces and the necks you stuck out." "I won't save them."
"But I promised it."
"I didn't."
"But we can't refuse them. Don't you see that they've got us hogtied? That they're holding us by the throat? Don't you know what they can do to us through this railroad pool, or through the Unification Board, or through the moratorium on our bonds?"
"I knew that 2 years ago." He was shaking. There was some formless, desperate, almost superstitious quality in his terror, out of proportion to the dangers he named. She felt suddenly certain that it came from something deeper than his fear of bureaucratic reprisal, that the reprisal was the only identification of it which he would permit himself to know, a reassuring identification which had a semblance of rationality and hid his true motive. She felt certain that it was not the country's panic he wanted to stave off, but his own, that he and Chick Morrison and Wesley Mooch and all the rest of the looting crew needed her sanction, not to reassure their victims, but to reassure themselves, though the allegedly crafty, the allegedly practical idea of deluding their victims was the only identification they gave to their own motive and their hysterical insistence. With an awed contempt, awed by the enormity of the sight, she wondered what inner degradation those men had to reach in order to arrive at a level of self-deception where they would seek the extorted approval of an unwilling victim as the moral sanction they needed, they who thought that they were merely deceiving the world.
"We have no choice," he cried. "Nobody has any choice."
"Get out of here," she said, her voice very quiet and low. Some tonal quality in the sound of her voice struck the note of the unconfessed within him. As if never allowing it into words, he knew from what knowledge that sound had come. He got out. She glanced at Eddie. He looked like a man worn by fighting one more of the attacks of disgust, which he was learning to endure as a chronic condition. After a moment, he asked, "Dagny, what became of Quentin Daniels? You were flying after him, weren't you?"
"Yes,"
she said.
"He's gone."
"To the destroyer?" The word hit her like a physical blow. It was the first touch of the outer world upon that radiant presence, which she had kept within her all day, as a silent, changeless vision, a private vision, not to be affected by any of the things around her, not to be thought about, only to be felt as the source of her strength. The destroyer, she realized, was the name of that vision here in their world. Yes, she said dully with effort. To the destroyer. Then she closed her hands over the edge of the desk to steady her purpose and her posture, and said with the bitter hint of a smile, Well, Eddie, let's see what two impractical persons like you and me can do about preventing the train wrecks. It was 2 hours later when she was alone at her desk, bent over sheets of paper that bore nothing but figures, yet were like a motion picture film unrolling to tell her the whole story of the railroad in the past 4 weeks, that the buzzer rang, and her secretary's voice said, Mrs. Reardon to see you, Miss Taggart. Mr. Reardon? She asked incredulously, unable to believe either. No, Mrs. Reardon. She let a moment pass, then said, Please ask her to come in. There was some peculiar touch of emphasis in Lillian Reardon's bearing when she entered and walked toward the desk. She wore a tailored suit, with a loose bright bow hanging casually sidewise for a note of elegant incongruity, and a small hat tilted at an angle considered smart by virtue of being considered amusing. Her face was a shade too smooth, her steps a shade too slow, and she walked almost as if she were swinging her hips. "How do you do, Miss Taggart?" she said in a lazily gracious voice, a drawing-room voice, which seemed to strike in that office the same style of incongruity as her suit and her bow. Dagny inclined her head gravely. Lillian glanced about the office. Her glance had the same style of amusement as her hat, an amusement purporting to express maturity by the conviction that life could be nothing but ridiculous. "Please sit down," said Dagny. Lillian sat down, relaxing into a confident, graceful, casual posture. When she turned her face to Dagny, the amusement was still there, but its shading was now different. It seemed to suggest that they shared a secret, which would make her presence here seem preposterous to the world, but self-evidently logical to the two of them. She stressed it by remaining silent. "What can I do for you?" "I came to tell you," said Lillian pleasantly, "that you will appear on Bertram Scudder's broadcast tonight." She detected no astonishment in Dagny's face, no shock, only the glance of an engineer studying a motor that makes an irregular sound. "I assume," said Dagny, "that you are fully aware of the form of your sentence."
"Oh, yes," said Lillian.
"Then proceed to support it."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Proceed to tell me." Lillian gave a brief little laugh, its forced brevity betraying that this was not quite the attitude she had expected.
"I'm sure that no lengthy explanations will be necessary," she said. "You know why your appearance on that broadcast is important to those in power. I know why you have refused to appear. I know your convictions on the subject. You may have attached no importance to it, but you do know that my sympathy has always been on the side of the system now in power. Therefore, you will understand my interest in the issue and my place in it. When your brother told me that you had refused, I decided to take a hand in the matter. Because, you see, I am one of the very few who know that you are not in a position to refuse."
"I am not one of those few as yet," said Dagny. Lillian smiled.
"Well, yes, I must explain a little further. You realize that your radio appearance will have the same value for those in power as the action of my husband when he signed the gift certificate that turned Reardon Metal over to them. You know how frequently and how usefully they have been mentioning it in all of their propaganda?"
"I didn't know that," said Dagny sharply.
"Oh, of course. You have been away for most of the last 2 months, so you might have missed the constant reminders, in the press, on the radio, in public speeches, that even Hank Reardon approves of and supports Directive 10-289, since he has voluntarily signed his medal over to the nation. Even Hank Reardon. That discourages a great many recalcitrants and helps to keep them in line."
She leaned back and asked in the tone of a casual aside,
"Have you ever asked him why he signed?"
Dagny did not answer. She did not seem to hear that it was a question. She sat still, and her face was expressionless, but her eyes seemed too large, and they were fixed on Lillian's, as if she were now intent upon nothing but hearing Lillian to the end.
"No, I didn't think you knew it. I didn't think that he would ever tell you,"
said Lillian, her voice smoother, as if recognizing the signposts and sliding comfortably down the anticipated course.
"Yet you must learn the reason that made him sign, because it is the same reason that will make you appear on Bertram Scudder's broadcast tonight.
She paused, wishing to be urged. Dagny waited.